Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is John Bridges of Guild Financial Advisory, Masters of Finance. I'm very, very proud to be able to tell you that today I have in my studio James Ashton, Chief Exec of the Quoted Company Alliance, which many of you remember was set up 30 years ago, just over 30 years ago, to represent the interests of smaller companies listed in London. James, good morning and welcome to you.
Morning, John. It's great to be here in the studio with you.
James, you write books. You are a journalist. You continue to do all of those things. You've done other things. Can you give me and my listeners some flavour?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for doing your research, which is the sort of thing I would always do before coming to interview somebody, and I'm still getting used to being the person answering the questions, by the way. So I've been a financial journalist for most of my career, and that includes writing for Reuters, The Scotsman, Daily Mail, Sunday Times, Evening Standard, Telegraph Independent. I like to say if it was still there, it's kind of a long way along Fleet Street. I think I've been lucky to be at a number of these titles. Self-employed for several years, where I carried on writing. I did consulting work, a lot of event facilitation, got into books, as you said. And yes, the QCA opportunity came along just about this time last year. I started in October 2022.
And you've got one or two books underway at the minute, I believe. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, of course. Well, I got into books when I was asked to help someone write one. And then you kind of have to get over this psychological barrier of going from, well, the longest piece I've ever written is 2,500 words. And then suddenly you're talking about, how do I fill a bucket that's 80,000 words? And so writing with other people, and the best known one of those was a book I co-wrote on FTSE and stock indices in general with Mark Makepeace, who was the founding CEO of FTSE. He joined the stock exchange pre-Big Bang and led the creation of that company and its spin out. And then I've written a couple of my own. The Nine Types of Leader is one I did on all the different CEOs and leaders I've met and interviewed over the years. And I put those into my own taxonomy, you know, the lover, the scion, and so on. And then the book I put out most recently, which was kind of one that was, I was finishing the work as the QCA opportunity came up, is called The Everything Blueprint. That's the story of Arm, the Cambridge microchip designer, very much in the news at the moment. It's the one that got away for the London markets, and it's the one that will be floating on NASDAQ if they get the price and they polish it up appropriately next month. So it's all of that story, how it came to pass. There's great old names in there like Acorn Computers, because Arm was born from the ashes of Acorn, and also how it sits in this global semiconductor ecosystem, as we're encouraged to call it, you know, how it sits between the financial might of America, which is the home of the microchip, and the manufacturing might of Asia, which is where all of these things are made these days. And clearly, it's a very, very political industry, and it affected many of us or all of us when the fridges we ordered in lockdown or the new laptops we ordered in lockdown didn't arrive because there weren't enough chips being made.
I remember it well. Yes. So, talk about, please, the QCA, where it is today and what it's doing and where it sits in the market in which it operates.
So the QCA, as you point out, it has got that 30-year heritage. And we talked about a previous guest you've had on this series, John. Of course, Brian Winterflood is our founding father, whatever you might call him. He was absolutely essential to the creation of the QCA. Predates me, of course, but he was our president up to 2016. Yep. So very, very closely involved, and we have strong links still with Winterflood Securities. So where the QCA is, we're champion of the public markets. We're particularly the voice of small cap and mid cap stocks. And I think we are campaigning on behalf of our members. The thing that really thrilled me coming in and doing my research on the organization is we do have really good links into what I call the big five, the institutions that really matter, the ones that can make changes and improve the lot of our members. And that's FCA, FRC, the business department, Treasury, and I count the stock exchange in there as well, because they are disproportionately important in terms of a piece of infrastructure. So I think in terms of what we do, we are seeking to make life better for our members. We think our members are 300 companies, of which roughly two-thirds are the corporates, the companies, as I'm increasingly calling them, the golden eggs, because if you take them all away, then we've nothing to do. We don't need to talk. we're probably not in business, either of us.
No.
And then the remaining third, very important, are the advisors, and that community goes, it's really everyone that's supporting the companies, of course, including the nomads, the brokers, the corporate advisors, accountants, lawyers, but also PR companies, ESG consultants, headhunters, all of that mix are in there. And we want to make life better for these companies that choose to be publicly quoted, because we see great upside in a public quote. And I think this is what got lost in some of the conversation. I come from it. The first point for me is public markets are good because. So why are public markets good? Because if the public markets are working properly, companies can raise capital to grow. They can operate transparently, which is great for staff, suppliers, community, whatever. And it's a perfect mechanism by which to distribute wealth. These companies should and do and aim to make wealth. So distributing that widely and fairly to anyone who is free to buy those shares. So this seems to be a pretty good system. What the challenges are, there's too much cost and complexity. There's not enough liquidity. There's not enough buyers and sellers. And I think the narrative is not as good as it should be. I think we need people to understand, and we need companies to say, well, I want to grow. I'm going to sell some shares. I'm going to raise some capital that way. That should be the de facto choice. And of course, the numbers, as we've seen them, what are there? 4 million old companies in the UK. There's maybe, depending on how you cut them, there's certainly sub 2,000 that have a public quote. These public markets, although we see in the media all the time, the FTSE 100's done this, the All Share did that, and so on. We do run the risk that we're talking about a fringe activity now. And I think we need to be able to rebalance towards public from private.
I want to pick you up on a point you mentioned just now. Liquidity.
Yep.
Are we expecting, or is the city expecting too much from a small company? 5 million market cap maybe on a market where the directors still have a significant amount of the stock.
I think what I've seen in talking to members is actually, this gets me into the area of things like proxy agencies and so on. You know, I think some of the joy of building these businesses in the public arena is that you can build long-term relationships with institutional shareholders. The investor roadshow post-results doesn't need to take very, very long. You have a core number of very significant shareholders. So I think all of those shareholders buying in to a company of that size would A, hope that it grows, and B, expect to be in for a while. I don't think they would expect there to be, they wouldn't expect it to be as liquid, of course, as a huge blue chip or something.
No.
I think the concern is that they were always likely going to be less liquid than those larger stocks, but I think the concern is that the liquidity in their career time has significantly fallen, and that there's a feeling that a number of institutions won't operate at a certain market cap level. And I think there's an equation that kind of seeks to say that lack of liquidity is, so low liquidity is high risk. And I think that's a real concern that we've got into. So I think there is fair cause for concern. And I think there are things that we can do to address all of these measures. That's the answer I didn't give, actually. What do we do just to fill that in? Clearly, we are talking to all of those departments I talked about. We're pressing them on either a number of consultations and things that are in train, and there are so many of them, but also we're being proactive as well on areas where we think companies deserve a better deal. And then on behalf of the companies, there's quite a lot in terms we do in terms of publications and training. We also operate the QCA Corporate Governance Code, which is followed by the majority of AIM and a significant number of companies on AQUIS and also on the standard list. And then there's, I think, what you'd expect of any trade group. There is the networking piece. There's the opportunity to meet, share ideas, etc., through dinners, through conferences,
yep,
and so on. One of the things that we do, one of the most popular series of events we have, John, is lunches with a fund manager. So people like Tellworth, Schroders, JP Morgan Asset Management. I think there are the institutions, and I think within each of these, it's about having that person, the individual who sees the joy in small companies and sees the opportunity, because let's face it, we're all here to make money. I think there are fewer of them, but what's clear is that it's become a lot harder for smaller companies. In a number of instances, the retail investor is providing the liquidity. And so we know, and I'll take the AIM market, for instance, because I've got this on my mind. We've just passed the 10th anniversary of when AIM shares were admissible into ISAs.
Yep.
The aim is 24% retail owned now, which includes director shareholdings. So that's double the rate of the 12% retail holding of the London market, you know, across the piece. So clearly, there's greater retail interest. And we know, because we've done research on it in the last year or so, that those companies that really cultivate the retail base, it does have a benefit for liquidity. I think your point was, should we really grumble about the lack of liquidity? And I think we can certainly say it's worse. We can certainly think how we get it better. But you can also look at the point of view that so many more individuals are doing their own thing now, self-directed pensions. And I think companies of all sizes, including small ones, need to know how to cater to that audience.
Well, I'm glad you've responded to this one, because you've mentioned some very interesting institutional names there. And the situation is no different now from what it was 30, 40 years ago when I was active. Aren't there some restrictions on appealing to retail investors, particularly in terms of distribution of research material?
Well, there is, and research is very top of mind at the moment, because there's a useful work stream ongoing at the moment. There was a piece of work done by a lawyer from Hogan Lovells called Rachel Kent,
yep,
really looking to how we can revive equity research. So I'll come on to that. But yes, there are restrictions. I think I would observe there's a lot companies can do to make sure that before you get to the research stage, actually their website says and does everything. You know, if I wanted to buy a share today, probably the first place I would look would be the company's website. So, yeah. So I think there's always a job of work to make sure the website actually says what it does on the tin.
Yeah.
And so on.
There's no excuse for not doing so.
Yes. And then I think there's also, I would say this as a lifelong journalist, I think the media can play a positive role as well. And then with research, look, we want research to be more freely available. And the point that we've made to Rachel, and it's come out in this review, and we're pressing ahead talking to Treasury about next steps now, is if we have so many retail investors, why should they be left to trade on a rumour they picked up in a chat room or on Twitter, as opposed to having a look at a well-turned piece of independent research? So we need to look at rules around financial promotion, how these things are distributed. But I think the key point on research, John, is people don't trade into a vacuum. Unless there are voices and opinions and thoughts and forecast numbers out and about there for companies, then people just aren't going to trade. So this is where this idea of subsidized research comes from. We think that if you can get three sources covering a company, you need three to make a consensus to sort of bounce off each other. So how can we set up the market so that post-MiFID II, so that there is enough wherewithal for people to want to write on these companies and give investors the confidence to trade without piling more cost onto the companies? I would say we don't like that. We don't want to see the smallest companies left behind, or else we have to make it as user-friendly as possible. If there is going to be some sort of subsidy scheme, and there's talk that possibly the exchanges could contribute towards this, as they do in many of the markets around the world. Really interesting idea that's being put forward is you can take a slice of stamp duty that would help to create a pot off which you would generate new research. And that would be for all. That would be for all. There's no point in pulling up the drawbridge at 50 million or 20 million or something, you know.
Where are these talks at in terms of progressing?
Well, the broad point is all eyes are on the Chancellor in whenever it will be, late October, early November. He has said that is the point at which the government will act on the attractiveness of, I think he said, the London Stock Exchange, but we want people to be able to choose across all markets.
Yep.
So a lot of things are leading up to that. And there's things there about how you consolidate pension funds and actually get these institutions investing back into Britain again. And also research is there as well. So what we'll do going into autumn, I'll be writing to Andrew Griffith, the Economic Secretary, and just with our response to what Rachel came out with in, I think, July, setting out our preferences and really pushing to make sure that this very good review doesn't go to waste. Because I think research, I don't know if you agree, I think that there's no silver bullet, as people say, but I think research is a significant part of this. If you aren't helping people discover and understand the growth potential and the opportunities that these companies offer, then they're not going to trade. And there's so many other things that we're doing. You know, shareholder communications, we think some of the retail platforms like Hargreaves Lansdowne make it too difficult for companies to reach and communicate with their shareholders. There's a big piece of work we're doing at the moment, which doesn't sound particularly glamorous, the non-financial reporting review. We think annual reports are a great constraint on public companies. We did a piece of work at the start of this year. Even companies on AIM, flexible regulation, 40,000 words in that document. If you're looking at FTSE 100, you're looking at annual reports of north of 100,000 words. This is very, very symbolic of stuff that's going wrong with public markets. You know, so we need to simplify, make it more attractive for all. If you go back 15 years, post-financial crisis, the City of London was the pariah.
Yep.
It's not the pariah anymore. Very positive. It is seen by politicians of both colours, the City of London, of which sometimes the public markets are seen as a key proponent. There's lots of other stuff in there as well. It's growth infrastructure now. If they're looking at 1 to 2% GDP growth, they're thinking, how on earth are we going to get the UK economy going again? And actually, there's a realisation that what we have in the City of London can help to get everything else moving right across the UK. And we have members way outside of London. So that's a positive. The second thing as well, I think, is that if you go back a couple of years in the aftermath of Brexit as well, I think there was a complacency. The City of London, it'll be fine. It'll always be there. And I think actually with things like Arm, choosing New York over London, and lots of other examples as well, and the de-equitization, the loss of companies we've seen, I think there is no longer the complacency. So I think those are two great things that we can work with. So I think the politicians on both sides see that the markets are not yet fit for the future. And they, ever since Lord Hill was brought in almost 3 years ago to look at this, work has been going on. And so I think we're reaching a point at which some of that will start to make a difference. Clearly, the Tories need some good news. Election year is beckoning. And actually, I think in the engagement I've had with Labour, I think they get it too. I think we're at kind of a, I hesitate to say, I don't know whether it's 1992 or 1997, because that would be to call the winner. But I think actually their language and their behaviour is moving closer together again. Yeah. And I think for our markets and our members, there's a lot of positive we can take from that.
Hmm. Yes, 1992 and 1997 were both interesting years, worth looking back to,
yes.
And clearly you have done as well. What about the notion of getting pension funds to invest in smaller companies? How practical is that?
I think it depends how much we want to make it happen. I mean, I was at the Mansion House dinner in July. The Mansion House Compact was signed. This was £50 billion
yep.
coming into growth assets, including unlisted, which is positive. My point on that is 50 was announced, 50 wasn't committed on the day. That's a 2030 solution. So can't wait to get some money into the markets at the smaller end in 7 years' time. I do worry that we are focusing on fit for the future and not focusing enough on how we make sure that these markets are functioning as well as they can today. Because we know we're losing at least one public company every week, at least that.
That's across the board, isn't
it? Yeah, that is, if I take AIM plus Main, that is the,
yep.
That's that figure. And clearly, Aquis is a considerable contributor there, had a very good, certainly good 2022. So yeah, but broadly, that's the direction of travel. I think it is practical. And clearly there's concerns within the industry. It's a very well-resourced industry from a lobbying point of view. They don't want to be mandated to have to buy British. Issues over overhauling the role of the pension trustee and so on. I don't think it needs to be really as difficult as this. We should be able to, and there shouldn't be anything, you know, embarrassing or something about money being managed in London, and a lot of that British money, and particularly a lot of that public money, public funds, pensions for state workers and so on, being, you know, backing British assets, because currently we're spending too much money creating world-beating companies in Vietnam or Colombia or something, and I think there are growth companies all over London market. So I think there are certain things we can do on the tax perspective to channel more money into the smaller end of the market. There's lots we can do. VCTs have been a great success. We can change some of the rules around VCTs, or we can suggest new models that look very VCT-like. So I think either it's carrot or stick, isn't it? The government could say you must invest this. And the easier way is, look at these tax incentives. So we'll be putting our ideas to the Chancellor. We want a very simple set of things out of the budget in November. And what they will all have in common is there'll be things that can be enacted pretty quickly, because we think we need to act pretty quickly, not 2030.
James, I have enjoyed this enormously. I hope you have too. Thank you for coming along today. I wish you and your team well. Thank you.
Really, thank you, John.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe on your favourite podcast app. This content is issued by Guild Financial Advisory Limited, which is authorised and regulated in the United Kingdom by the Financial Conduct Authority for designated investment business and is a member of the Aquis Stock Exchange. Nothing in this podcast should be viewed as investment advice. Listeners should consult an investment professional before making any decision regarding topics mentioned in this podcast. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and not of Guild Financial Advisory. Please note that participants within this podcast may have financial interests in the matters discussed.